Hughes, host Dale Holliday, lists 11 aggravating statements, actions, and beliefs often directed toward people of color from white progressives who should know better. We're going to finish out the 10 o'clock hour with Flashpoints with your host, Dennis Bernstein. That's all coming up right after these important announcements, so stay tuned.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Rocker T and the 7th Street Band on Saturday, January 6th, beginning at 9 p.m. at Mississippi Studios in Portland. Rocker T is from Brooklyn and has 7 albums released by a number of labels playing reggae and reggaeton. Also performing will be local artist Aaron Nigel Smith, Heavy City, and DJ Kansaman. Again, that's Rocker T and the 7th Street Band on Saturday, January 6th, 9 p.m. at Mississippi Studios, 3939 North Mississippi Avenue in Portland. More information may be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
I'm out to sing songs that will prove to you that this is your world, and that if it's hit you pretty hard and knocked you down for a dozen loops, no matter how hard it's run you down and rolled over you, no matter what color, what size you are, how you're built, I am out to sing the songs that will make you take pride in yourself.
I'm Lori Sonnenfeld.
And I'm Don Jacobson.
Together we bring you Movin' On, Fridays from 12 noon to 1:30.
We feature both traditional and contemporary folk music.
We love to present live in-studio concerts from local and national musicians.
Tune in and you'll hear music that is socially progressive, moving, and heartfelt.
Music heard only on the left-hand edge of the dial and only on KBOO.
Every Friday, noon to 1:30.
We who believe in freedom cannot rest.
Hi, I'm Dale Holliday coming to you from Corvallis, Oregon in the bountiful Willamette Valley. Welcome to my show, Valley Views, a forum for sharing relevant topics relating to people and issues in the Willamette region. There's a national group called Surge, standing up for racial justice. And there's a branch in Portland, Corvallis, Oregon, and many other parts of the U.S. From what I understand, one of the main goals of this group is to organize white people to speak out against racism and to call out the systemic racism that surrounds us. The thought is that white people too often dismiss this message when it comes from people of color, but they may listen to fellow white people when they say, yes, racism does exist, and this is what it looks like. I was invited to attend one of the Corvallis Surge meetings. As part of my appearance, I asked to read a piece I'd written about some of the things that white people do that makes me angry. I'm talking about white people who you would think should know better, but they don't. I read the piece to the group to try and give them some insights about my experiences as a black woman in Corvallis, because I know that many of the residents here think that Corvallis is a progressive town. So how could there be racism or racist acts here? And yes, Corvallis is a progressive town in many aspects. So many communities across this nation are, but that does not mean that cultural awareness exists. So before I read this piece, I want to say that I'm not speaking for all African Americans. But these are things that have happened time and time again to every single black woman that I know in some form or another, and it's not just in Corvallis. So here we go. 11 things that white, liberal, progressive, educated, enlightened people do that as a black woman I really, really hate. Number one, when we know each other through work or the neighborhood, but you never greet me unless I say hi first. Even if we're the only two people walking toward each other in the hallway or on the sidewalk, if I don't initiate the greeting, you get a fearful kind of deer in the headlight expression as if you fear I'm going to stab you. If I say nothing, you say nothing, and we pass like strangers. but I get really weary of making the first friendly gesture every single time. Number two, when you mix me up with other African American women of vastly different skin shade, height, weight, age, and hair type, and not just once, constantly. Number three, when you ask me to tell you about an unjust or racist encounter to better understand the dynamic. When I begin to tell you, calmly and without blame, you, one, argue with me about my experiences, telling me that it wasn't racism, or two, claim that I'm being negative. No, I'm not being negative. I'm relaying negative experience. Number four, when you literally back away from me when I'm calmly relaying information to you to make a point, give feedback, or explain something unsettling that has occurred that I need to share. I'm not being negative. I'm relaying a fact about something negative that occurred. See previously number three. Five, when during the course of conversation, you ask me to share my observations regarding inequality and societal barriers that blacks and other people of color face. I try to explain how the privilege dynamic connects. You get defensive, shut your ears, shut your eyes, and run away. Remember, you asked. Six, insisting that you're colorblind. Nonsense. But if that really is true, you're blind to the realities and experiences that comprise my life, all things that relate to defining who I am and how I navigate the world. Seven, when you use the term post-racial America and actually believe that term has validity. Eight, when you're just a little too eager to inform me that you've adopted a brown-skinned child, or that someone in your family is dating or married to a brown-skinned person. I'll have to go take an aside here and say, I never want to ever again hear the term cocoa baby or choco baby or chocolate baby that I've heard far too often from women referring to their mixed grandkids. Number nine, when you're conversing with other whites, all of you listing your ancestral lines, Scotch, English, Irish, Swedish, etc., then become jaw-drop astonished when I list my own. African, Native American, French, German, Welsh, Haitian. Are you so ignorant of historic realities? Colonization, slavery, and yes, even free will have all resulted in my family tree being as multi-ethnic as yours. Number 10. Talking in black dialect, and I'll put quotes around black dialect, at any time for any reason. I don't care who you're mimicking or if you've heard some name brand celebrity of any color doing it on TV, movies, TED Talks, or the latest Vine video. I don't care if your post-racial America kids are doing it. I don't want to hear that talk, that mimicry from anyone. Number seven. And this is not limited to educated progressive liberals, but I had to put it in here anyway, because it's happened so often, far too often. When I approach a clerk, receptionist, or some type of info staff who scowl at me the moment I enter the establishment and before I even speak, I've witnessed them smiling and warmly greeting each white person who approached them ahead of me, but I get the icy stare and the clipped, "Can I help you?" The sense I get is that they think I don't belong there, I'm going to make a problem for them, or I'm just trouble. I present my needs clearly and in English, yet they continue to scowl, not, quote, understanding, end quote, what I'm saying. I seem to throw them even with a very simple question like, "How late is the store open today?" Or, "Where's the ladies' fitting room?" In his 1903 work, The Souls of Black Folk, W.E.B. Du Bois posed the question, "How does it feel to be a problem?" He posed this to black folks. "Well, I hope that I've given you just a taste of what that can feel like. To quote the genius author James Baldwin, to be black and conscious in America is to be in a constant state of rage. A truer statement was never spoken, as far as I'm concerned. To survive racism without going crazy, you can't ignore it. Many well-meaning white people try to sweep it under the rug, whistling past the graveyard, my husband likes to call it. They say it's an unpleasant topic, makes them feel bad. I say, if it makes them feel bad, how do they think I and others like me feel? I wish it weren't the case, but anger is not a stranger to me. But anger is not necessarily a bad thing either. Anger gets kind of a bad rap these days. Being angry doesn't mean you're going to go out and hurt somebody. I say it's normal to get angry about racism. Shows you're thinking. Anger helps you push back. Anger can be the fuel for fighting racism as well as other injustices in our society. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it. Thanks. You've been listening to Valley Views. I'm your host, Dale Holliday, and I'd love to hear from you. Comments, questions, ideas for future topics, or other matters you'd like explored. Email me at valleyviews@kboo.org. That's ValleyViews at kboo.org. I look forward to being with you again next time. And remember, as Doctor Who once said, I'm not in charge, but I'm full of ideas. Bye.
I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints, and we are delighted to be joined by William Binney. William Binney is the former technical director at the National Security Agency. You could call him a very courageous whistleblower who told the truth about what's happening behind the scenes at that agency that affects really all of us. It is a delight to have you with us. We've been wanting to talk to you, William Binney, for a long time, so welcome to Flashpoints.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, I would like you to begin by talking a little bit about your own background. I want people to understand where you are, as they say, coming from. Say a little bit about your background at the NSA and how you got there.
Well, I was in the United States Army from 1965 to 1969, and they put me in the Army Security Agency, which is the SIGINT branch of the Army And it's really NSA-CSS, so that means the Combined Security Services, CSS. That means Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine components of SIGINT. That's all under NSA. So that's how I got affiliated with NSA. And after that, I solved a few things here and there, and they kind of liked that. So they wanted me on a priority hire in 1970, which is when I started with them. And I was there for about 32 years, mostly working against the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact, solving those wizard puzzles. It's called the Puzzle Palace. NSA is called the Puzzle Palace. by some people anyway. And I had to solve code systems and work on cipher systems and data system work, solve some data systems and things like that to be able to figure out what was going on and predict in advance the kinds of things that they're supposed to do, intentions and capabilities of adversaries or potential adversaries.
And at a certain point, I think you ran amiss of your supervisors. What is it that you did and understood and tried to tell the people that got you in some Dutch with your supervisors?
Well, I was trying to solve the digital age problems, which we basically did in 1998 and 99, and basically created a problem for the director and everybody because they were lobbying Congress for $3.8 billion to do the same thing that we had just succeeded at. And they started that lobby in 1999 and for a separate program called Trailblazer, which failed miserably in 2005 and 6. But, you know, it went against the drive to get money for the agency because Congress was coming back saying, look, you've already solved these kinds of things that because the Congress was supporting us and giving us money to do this. So we were briefing them according to the regulations we had to. They would request briefings and they'd come in and we'd give them to them to tell them that where we were progressing, how far we got, and when we actually solved things. So, but that ran contrary to the bid downtown for $3.8 billion up front, as a first cut of money, by the way, not the last. But that caused a problem for them. It's hard for them to argue that they have a problem that Congress knows that has already been solved internally. So that meant that Congress was telling me, why do you need the $3.8 billion? And so...